I can have proponents for the bill. Sir, thank you for being so gracious and having a good seat there. I've been watching you listen to Tim. Thank you very much. So many politicians that were ahead of you.
Well, they were very eloquent. My name is Dr. Stuart Grassi, and I'm a psychiatrist. And I probably recognized nationally as an expert on the effects of solitary confinement in prisoners. I've published some in this area, and I've also lectured at Harvard and other places on the issue. I am not simply a bleeding heart liberal. I've consulted with the Department of Defense. I've consulted on Guantanamo cases. I've just consulted for the Florida Department of Corrections. My job really is to explain that solitary confinement is by now well established to be toxic to mental functioning. I have presented material to the committee, including an extensive monograph that I wrote on this area, but at this point, the issue, I think, is really beyond doubt. And it does cause a very specific type of psychiatric syndrome. People deprived of an adequate level of sensory stimulation, perceptual stimulation, occupation, social stimulation, will inevitably, invariably, descend into a form of stupor, either a kind of mental fog in which they can't think well, and in which, now, over time, the very absence of stimulation causes whatever stimulation is in the environment to become toxic, people start hyper-responding to stimuli, so that notion of the water dripping and you can't get your mind off of it and it starts driving you crazy. There's nothing to distract the mind. The mind starts fixating on things. It starts going into a fog. And I've been credited with discovering this phenomenon. I did not discover this phenomenon. This phenomenon has been known since the early 19th century and has been extensively written about in the medical literature. My monograph will give you some of that history. In 1890, the United States Supreme Court held that a man who was convicted of murder and was sentenced to death, but was now given an additional 30 days, approximately 30 days of solitary confinement because of a change in the law, could not be sentenced under the new law because an additional 30 days of solitary confinement was an egregious additional punishment. The law was ex post facto. And the United States Supreme Court in 1890 said what I said 100 years later. This matter of solitary confinement is not a mere unimportant regulation as to the safekeeping of the prisoner. Experience with the system of solitary confinement demonstrated that there were serious objections to it. A considerable number of the prisoners fell, after even short confinement, into a semi-fatuous condition, a stupor, a delirium, from which it was next to impossible to arouse them, and others became violently insane. Others still committed suicide. While those who stood the ordeal better were not generally reformed, and in most cases did not recover sufficient mental activity to be of any subsequent service to the community. 1890, U.S. Supreme Court. Mr. Medley, because of that additional burden of 30 days, fear of 60 days of solitary confinement, the U.S. Supreme Court ordered he be released from prison, Colorado State Prison, as a matter of fact. That's what we understood in 1890. We've come a long way downhill from there. The issue became prominent in the news. If those of you remember the Korean War, the tremendous concern about the brainwashing of American prisoners swore by the Chinese, the KGB, brainwashing, and what was considered by the psychiatric community, by the State Department, by the Department of Defense to be the critical issue, solitary confinement. A huge body of experimental literature was started as a result of that, studying, using the laboratory, the profound sensory deprivation, short periods of time as a model for studying the effects of solitary confinement in prisons. Hundreds of articles were written on this issue. We know what these conditions do. I did not discover it. It's been in the literature for over 150 years. But we managed to forget it. We forgot it after 1890, and then we were rudely reminded of it in the Korean War. Now we're being rudely reminded of it at Guantanamo and the treatment of terrorists. Because what's happened is we have driven so many of these terrorists insane. We have destroyed the ability to get information from them. People think, well, that the U.S. government has been all in support of this harsh interrogation tactics, these solitary confinement. That's not true. The Department of Defense has, the CIA has, the FBI, which is the one agency in this government that really does the work of interrogation, has been violently opposed to it. He left Guantanamo, condemned it, because it doesn't work. Forget about its humanitarian or lack of humanitarian problems. It doesn't work. It drives people crazy. And we knew that. But that's not what I really need to tell you. What I need to tell you is that the use of long-term solitary confinement doesn't add to safety. It doesn't add to safety for the prisoners. It doesn't add to safety for the corrections officers. And most importantly, it presents an enormous danger to our community, because 95% of these guys get out. And we've succeeded in making them as violent, as crazy, as chaotic, as emotionally labile as we possibly can. And then we discharge them out, sometimes straight out of solitary confinement, and on a bus to our cities. I've seen it. I've been consulted on it when they do something awful, and they're not in their right mind. So what are we doing? We're not getting tough on crime. We're getting tough on ourselves. And remember, you worry about money. Generally around the country, about 5% of the budget in corrections goes to programs. Virtually all of it goes to security. It costs twice as much to house a person in solitary confinement as it does in general population generally. It's statistically the average. I believe that's true in Maine as well. So are you saving money? No. Are you leaving people? 95% of these guys are getting out. Are you going to put them in the worst possible situation? Create the greatest danger to our community? The idea of long-term solitary confinement is based on a paradigm, a correctional paradigm, which is if you punish bad behavior enough, it'll change, it'll stop. A good idea for probably everyone in this room. A terrible idea when it comes to the people who actually end up in solitary. The people who end up in solitary are not the James Cagneys of the prison system. They're not cold, calculating, rational human beings. Otherwise, they know when not to misbehave. They're going to get caught. These guys are emotionally labile. They're volatile. They're impulsive. They often have bipolar mood disorders, often have brain damage, often have mental illness, ADHD, drug addiction. And you put them in a very stringent environment, a stimulus deprivation environment, and this, precisely, is the group of people most vulnerable to becoming sick because of it. They become more volatile, they become more emotionally labile over time, and they become more violent. They become a greater danger to the security staff. And, of course, they become an enormous danger when they're finally released back to the community. The security staff, because their only paradigm is control, punishment, they don't understand that you take a guy like that, I've seen so many, hundreds, take a person like that, and the corrections staff says, we can't do anything but leave him in solitary confinement, goes to a psychiatric hospital finally, ends up in general population in the psychiatric hospital, he recovers. Over and over again. And we often end up with a revolving door. They go to the worst possible condition, solitary confinement, long-term solitary confinement, get so sick they end up psychiatrically hospitalized, they recover, they go back to solitary confinement. I've seen this over 20 times in one patient, one inmate, and that's not unique. Over and over, there's a revolving door problem. There's also the maxing out problem. You take a guy who's behaviorally a bit out of control, you put him in solitary, and he gets worse. And over time, he'll never get out. Can't. He's too sick. He's too volatile. He's too out of control. The correction staff doesn't know what else to do. And I respect that. But there are other paradigms. Remember that when we talk about intent, on one end of the spectrum is the James Cagney types, cold, calculating, rational. They know means for an ends. Those aren't the guys who end up in solitary confinement generally. It's generally the impulse-ridden, the chaotic, those people cannot respond to that paradigm. And when we talk about the safety, of course we're talking about safety. It's all about safety. But this does not enhance safety. Yes, do we need restrainers or somebody in solitary? In psychiatry, we have seclusion rooms when somebody's really out of control. We even have four-point restraints. For how long? 15 minutes? Half hour? An hour? We don't have it for 2 years. That's foolish. That makes it worse. And when they're in the quiet room, the seclusion room, or in four-point restraints, there is somebody talking to them constantly, trying to reach out to them, trying to calm them down, because they're out of control. I was going to mention this one lawsuit. I mean, I've been involved in so many, but this one is sort of ironic. Class action lawsuit, Langley versus Coggin, Bedford Hills Correctional Facility in New York State, the maximum security institution for women. The solitary confinement section was so horrible, grotesque. Women smearing feces, women screaming and hollering all day long, all night long, women eating feces, women eating parts of their own bodies. A horror. And we finally got a settlement in this case, and in the settlement, this type of behavior was required to be viewed at from a richer perspective, including mental health perspective. Well, I'm telling you, and I mean this totally, sincerely, that place quieted down. That place was much, much better for the inmates. And the CEOs loved it. They were so pleased with the result. And the named defendant from the Office of Mental Health, he ended up trying to take credit for it. He was a named defendant. It happened on his watch. But it was so successful that he tried to take credit for it. So I suggest to you that when I know there are so many people out here worried about safety, what they don't understand is that this is not the way to produce it. You've got to have a richer paradigm. These people are not generally James Cagneys. They're not cold, ruthless killers or, you know, whatever. They're mostly people who are emotionally labile, out of control, cognitively impaired, neurologically impaired, mental illness. And if you don't recognize that and you treat it as though the hope that correctional paradigm would work, you're going to make them sicker. You're going to make your corrections officers. You're going to have more corrections officers to control them. You're going to spend more money on their daily treatment, their daily care. And they're going to just never get out of there. And when they finally get out of prison, they're going to be a tremendous danger to your communities, to your towns. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that testimony. Thank you for coming here to give it. Representative Nassau.
Thank you very much. Dr. Gracia, that you're knowledgeable and passionate about this issue. We appreciate that passion. I do have some questions for you. I noted in here, and I haven't had a time to extensively read your testimony, that you did specifically talk about Maine. I wonder how long ago was it that you visited the facility?
My only comments about Maine were based on the information I had about policies and procedures, and I have not. I once visited a Maine facility, but that was a long time ago. This, I think you're talking about the.
Those
policies and procedures. I was actually surprised that Maine actually, you know, when I actually went through it and compared it with other jurisdictions, because I know quite a bit about other jurisdictions. Actually, it's worse in most respects in terms of... I mean, remember, too, when you talk about safety...
I did have a couple of other questions.
Well, if I could just finish that one thing. When you talk about safety, you're not necessarily talking about depriving people of radio, depriving them of books, depriving them of any kind of recreational opportunity. What you're describing is keeping them...
Mindset, you know.
I had no idea it was on. I'm not too techno-savvy.
As being, you know, the culprit or part of the culprit. what's long term? Clearly, there's some use of a special management unit or segregation for some purposes.
The term long term obviously depends on the individual. But when I compare it with psychiatric seclusion, for example, you're talking about minutes or hours. Here we're talking about months and years. I think months and years makes no sense. Minutes and hours certainly make sense. Are there cases where days and even weeks? Probably. But if you're going to leave someone there for days or weeks, it doesn't serve your purpose to deprive them so much of their ability to occupy themselves and have perceptually meaningful stimulation. I mean, even in the federal ADX in Colorado, they have closed-circuit TV, educational programming, and radio TV.
And this goes to my next question, which is the other thing you talk about in here is the severe restriction of environmental and social stimulation.
Exactly. Yeah.
And when I see either the long-term or severe, that tells me there's a continuum?
Well, I mean, think about, for example, the use of protective custody. I don't know how it's done in Maine, but generally people in protective custody are single celled for their protection, but they do recreate with others, not others who might be their enemies, but they're allowed out of their cells, they recreate, they can watch TV. You know, they have a lot of, even social phone calls, family phone calls, they're only once a week. A lot of places it's a lot more than that. You have the problem of the non-contact visits. That's not necessarily going to help safety. If you have people who are reaching out to their families, that would probably increase safety more than depriving them of that. So there's all kinds of things. You know, it's not just single-cell housing. It's 24 hours a day. How much of it are you outside of yourself? What kind of things can you do inside of yourself?
All right, I was just trying to get a sense of the continuum here because I certainly can understand what you're talking about with long-term and severe restrictions,
right,
and, you know, no contact, those kinds of things. And just wanted to see where on the continuum
I do think
need to be thinking.
Maine is, in my experience, I do have a fairly extensive experience with multiple jurisdictions. It's worse. I mean, it's the deprivation of occupational opportunities, educational opportunities, family connection through phone and especially visits. I mean, all of these are really critical kinds of things. And even though a person may be a danger, if he's put together with a whole bunch of other guys, there probably is some guys he could be put together with in recreation safely. And it would probably be a good thing. It would probably decrease the tension in the place. I've heard, from people who work in the correction system, officers, professional people, you take away programming, you take away those opportunities, and all you're left with is tension and violence. It's not a good idea, and it's a lot cheaper to add that programming in than to increase your security needs.
I'm sure that's consistently true throughout the facility, not just in the special management unit, but that programming and opportunity are the key to
absolutely
correctional.
Right. I mean, it's not a question of getting tough on crime. It's a question of making our society safe.
And not just in solitary confinement,
exactly,
but all the way through the system.
Right.
Thank
you.
Representative Sykes. Thank you, Senator Kozlowski. Dr. Gressian, the comparison that you made on how does Maine's SMU stack up, what's the database? I mean, obviously you reviewed the policies and came up with this evaluation. What's the total database that you use?
I can't specify that. This is from my experience. I've testified and inspected, evaluated there's actually a list of over 20 jurisdictions, state, federal jurisdictions, and at least probably more. And so, I just sort of know what's typical and what's not. Like the once a week telephone contact, it's a little bit worse than typical. Some places do, significantly better, some don't. The non-contact visits with attorneys, for example, it's really unusual. I can only think of one other place where I've seen that. So, you know, it's based on my own experience, but my experience is not that limited. I've certainly gone through a lot of jurisdictions.
We use terms such as a special management unit or solitary confinement. You use terms indicating that it's appropriate to be placed in isolation or a quiet room. Is the difference simply the time placed in isolation or a quiet room?
When a person is placed in a quiet room, it's an immediate exigency. And there's going to be somebody right outside that quiet room trying to connect with the person and calm them down. The hope and expectation is that the quiet room is going to last for a few minutes, maybe an hour or two, but, you know, I mean, it would be uncommon for it to be more than that. And there's somebody out there not just observing, but actually trying to kind of reach the person, calm them down.
Okay, going back to the how the SMU stacks up here in the state of Maine, this was done by a review of the policies provided to you from the Department of Corrections.
A lot of it was Department of Corrections policy.
I'm curious as to how you come up with a review of policy with a statement that says apparently almost always filled with screaming, noise, nauseous smells.
Oh, right. No, that's right. That was not a review of policy. That was by asking. That was by interviews. You're right. I interviewed a couple of people who were associated, you know, who had a lot of opportunity to view the prisons. One in particular that I recall was a fellow named Stan Looney, who was a chaplain, and he described the conditions. So that's right. I mean, there is a mixture there of some stuff I got from interview data, and mostly it's, I think, policies and procedures. So.
Thank you.
Senator Davis.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if I asked this question, but when I was in the Peace Corps in 1962 in this area, prisoners would get machetes and guns and knives, and they'd go to the grass and voices in Freetown. In America, we seem to have this competitive culture that just because struggle is part of our existence. So how do you change that?
Well, I think that that's a great question, by the way. And I think what happens is when you don't have a lot else going on, a lot of other opportunities, a lot of other ways of thinking about things, like if you don't have a rehab model, then I think the corrections folks end up in a kind of default position where the only thing left to do is to control and punish. And so I think that, you know, it becomes really very helpful to everyone to increase the sense of possibilities. I mean, I once toured the death row section of the Huntsville, Texas death row. Those guys had X-Acto knives in their cells. They were using them for crafts. X-Acto knives. They were in death row. They didn't have a lot to lose. It worked. And then, you know, they sold this stuff too. I mean, they had very intricate designs and what beautifully done. But give people opportunities. And sure, some days it's not going to go well. Some guys can take an X-Acto knife and do harm with it. But I bet you overall you're going to get a lot quieter, a lot safer environment when you give people opportunities.
Further questions from the committee? I have one or two, if you don't mind. I want to thank you very much for coming here when anybody comes up the way, and especially when they have something to say. I like to listen to them.
Thank you.
I usually have to ask them, are we talking about Maine or where you're coming from? You understand the accreditation process that our system works through?
I mean, I know some of the accreditation processes, like the ACA. I don't know what accreditation process you're referring to. Is it the ACA?
You understand that Maine has 100% compliance in all its facilities in the accreditation process.
Right.
You understand that?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay, great. Because as I was listening, reading through some of these, and I got some pointed questions, I'm wondering, I pick up the same thing that Representative Sykes picked up on, apparently. I've been through that facility at 7 o'clock at night. I've been there at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I have, apparently, I've gone through some of these experiences. So I'm going to ask you if you understand, when we get accredited here in the state of Maine, and we just went through one recently, that we get the highest marks in the country for our mental health unit. Are you aware of that?
No, I wasn't aware of that.
Okay, well, let's keep going down the road. Then I can ask questions down.
Can I clarify?
I have to answer.
I, I understand that some of your seriously mentally ill people are left in the 8-1 unit of an SMU and are basically in solitary confinement with very little access to any kind of environmental stimulation. I don't know what the ACA said about that, but that's fairly counterintuitive, and it's against any kind of notion of what works in psychiatry.
We actually have a board, a blog, that's designated to people with severe mental illness, where the guards only work in that pod, don't work throughout the system. They're also trained by NAMI, National
Association
of
Mental Health.
Those guards are trained that way, so we do have a little different system here than we have elsewhere in this country. I've been to probably a half a different state facilities, probably 20 county jails down in L.A. County, which is a real system. So I have a little bit of expertise in this, but I also know our system somewhat. And so when I look at our comparisons here, administrative punitive segregation in terms of confinement in Maine is worse than the average in some respects. Maybe you can explain to me how you come to the conclusion of, in some respects, they haven't spent much time there.
I'm sorry, which one are you referring to?
The third one down on your testimony.
Severely mental?
Administrative and punitive segregation.
Oh,
terms of confinement. You have in bold letters Maine that says worse than average in some respects.
Yes.
Maine is typical.
That's right. Maine is typical that those who are admitted to ADSEG do not receive finite sentences. But jurisdictions who use administrative SEG, in other words, the classification, instead of as a punishment, so there's no due process, generally have been held to the standard that the people in ADSEG should be given the same opportunities and amenities as those in general population, educational opportunities, visit opportunities, and things of that sort. And therefore, you can't have it both ways. If there is a due process for punitive SEG, well, then you can deprive people of things. But if there is no due process and it's seen as a classification, then the courts have generally held that the people in that setting should be given the same opportunities as if they were in general population. That's why I said it was.
Okay, of course. And that's the kind of clarification we need, because, again, I want to make sure that we're talking about our system.
Right. Well, I mean, this is what...
our accreditation process.
Well, I do think I say that quite explicitly here.
Okay.
That when it's a classification rather than a punishment, most jurisdictions generally recognize that inmates so classified should then legally have the same privileges, recreational, social, et cetera, as inmates of general population. It's my understanding that Maine doesn't do that. And that's for reviewing the policies and procedures.
Okay. When we go down to the mental health evaluations and monitoring, substantially worse than average.
Right.
Now, I'm having a problem understanding how you get accredited. How do you get accredited with the highest? Why do you have comments like that are made the highest in the country? And when we look at those reports, we see those numbers. And then I'm reading here substantially worse than average. So if you can just help me understand that a little bit.
Sure. In order for me to fully explain it, I would have to actually look at what they reviewed for the accreditation. And what they don't, because I haven't seen these kinds of they have certain checklists for accreditation. Now, if you do an interview, an evaluation of an inmate who's been sentenced to solitary confinement, if you do that interview through the solid steel door, you may create a record, a transactional record that may meet ACA requirements. Be acceptable to them, but if ACA doesn't actually inquire, did you take that person into a private room? If you're talking to an inmate through the solid steel door, through the food slot or the edge of the door, that there's no privacy, and it's exceedingly rare for an inmate to open up to a mental health worker under those conditions. My understanding, this is from interview, is that almost all evaluations, let alone monitoring, is done through the solid steel door. So that's, to me, grossly inadequate.
Okay. Go on to the next slide. I think there's a lot of judgment calls. You know, access to radio, television, educational cable, things like that. I think that we're going to go through that more and more, especially into the work session. My biggest concern were some of these very pointed, utterly inadequate, inaccurate, they don't work sometimes, being used. And if we know how we're going through accreditation, and if we know the process that we've come through for the last 5 years on getting prepared to go through accreditation,
yes,
and then having out-of-state people come here to accredit us, and we take pride in that, and we also spend a whole lot of money in accomplishing it. And then I see another professional's opinion using terms like utterly inadequate.
Yes.
Now, that's through testimony, secondhand testimony especially. I'd like to know the difference of that. Is that the case, or is it actually the case of you or your staff or people that you work with actually going there and visiting it and then coming back?
I have not visited it. Most of these comments, though, are not subjective comments. They're access to radio, television, educational cable programming is much less than average. It is. There's no doubt about it. Cell door ability to communicate with others is somewhat less than average it's somewhat less because there are jurisdictions still that have bar doors where it's a lot easier to communicate. So it's somewhat less. The personal property in the cell, commissary items, it's worse than most places. I mean, it is. That's a fact.
Can I just interrupt on that one moment?
Sure.
If we don't allow tobacco in Maine facilities, but we allow tobacco in Tennessee facilities, would it be held against Maine for not allowing tobacco as in keeping tobacco as a contraband compared to in Tennessee? It wouldn't be considered a contraband.
No, you're
am I mixing things up?
You are. Because,
okay, great. Tell me why.
We're comparing the ability of a SMU inmate to access commissary with the ability of a GP inmate to access commissary. If Maine doesn't want tobacco, I support Maine. But that means GP and SMU. That's the difference. The thing about the utterly inadequate is my understanding, and perhaps I'm wrong, but this is what I was referring to me, that in A1, in the A1 unit where most of the severely mentally ill are housed, they are basically held in solitary confinement with very little in the way of any kind of stimulation except for the counseling they get, the one-to-one counseling. And I've heard that the counseling itself is pretty good. You know, but that's not enough. I mean, that's an hour, you know, a couple times a week. That's doesn't make up for the lack of social, occupational stimulation. Now, if I'm wrong, if I was informed incorrectly, then correct me. But if that is the truth, then I think that's really striking. I have never heard of a place doing that.
Well, my role here is not to challenge you, but to have you inform me, and then through future testimony,
we're
all going to flush out what's what, where.
Right.
But I see Representative Sykes has a question he'd like to ask.
Thank you, Senator Zosky. Dr. Gressing, just so that I understand how this evaluation, putting Maine in perspective with other facilities, mostly average, worse than average,
yes,
inadequate, how that was determined was a review of the policies provided to you by the Department of Corrections for the Maine State Prison, conversations with former chaplain Stan Moody. You did not have an Excel sheet with columns of 20 facilities that you're familiar with and a section that says pillow or no pillow, 2-inch mattress or pillow top or whatever it happens to be. You did not have that type of an evaluation.
The Excel sheet, I hope, is accurate, but it's in my brain. I've seen enough facilities that, you know, you start looking at the differences. You know, if like you go to 100 Howard Johnsons, after a while you notice the differences because there's a lot of similarities, but you start noticing the differences. So I think that my statements about what other jurisdictions do are pretty accurate, and I feel pretty comfortable with that. The interview data, you know, when it does come from an interview, I'm just relying on the person with whom I spoke.
Further question, Representative Burke, please.
Thanks, Senator. Thank you, Doctor. I'm curious, these
working for them.
I'm sure they have learned about the
we can spend any time working within the facility with inmates and with some of the SMUs. And
when you say working with inmates, I mean, much of my work is doing tours and evaluating and talking with inmates. There are times, like when I worked with the Florida Department of Corrections, where I spent a significant amount of time talking to staff. I do that sometimes, too. I mean, often staff are actually pretty willing to sit down and talk, you know, at facilities, even when they're defendants in a class action lawsuit. So, basically those types, I don't treat patients in a prison. So we evaluated a number of inmates in prison and done tours of a lot of prisons, read policies and procedures, talked to staff, wardens.
Have you encountered any of these people that are confined to SMUs that were not manageable and were not capable of being placed in the general population because of their safety or somebody else's?
Well, I mean, what I said before was that many people who are unmanageable in an SMU and get to the point where they're so messed up that they end up in a psychiatric hospital recovered. So they're unmanageable in one environment, but they're not necessarily unmanageable in another.
I've had personal experience with that.
Oh, absolutely. As I mentioned, this revolving door business where, you know, you see the guy, he goes to the psychiatric hospital, he does well, and then what do? They put him right back in solitary confinement where he got sick. He got sick in the same characteristic way, that psychotic delirium. He goes back to the hospital. And, you know, they used to ask, do you want all the hospital records? And I foolishly could say yes, and I'd end up with these U-Haul boxes. There's so many records. And it's back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. It's a very common phenomenon, this revolving door.
So the institution basically caused that behavior?
Yes. Yes. It's not because they intentionally caused the behavior, but I think the use of solitary confinement causes that behavior. And if you don't understand that, I mean, it is, in a way, it is kind of frightening that I was the one who wrote the articles, because I didn't work in a correctional setting. There are psychiatrists who work in these correctional settings, and some of it's really obvious. And the literature I read and reviewed and is in the monograph I provided you, it's accessible. I mean, it's not hidden secret literature. It shouldn't have been someone from outside the system, because, you know, reminding people of what we already know. And it's a little scary that it took someone from outside the system to remind people of what we should have already known 100 years ago.
Representative Agnew.
Time is of the essence, as we say. Is time one of the major factors here? Suppose there was a use of this for decompression, and it was a matter of a few. As you said, with mentally ill, it could be minutes or hours. If it's in a progressive or hospital prisoner, not necessarily a mentally ill person, would it have been a matter of 5 or 10 days be considered inadequate to decompress that person, and then they would be ready to go back and reacquire the kinds of privileges.
You're confusing, I think, two things. One is, if they're really unmanageable in general population, they have to be isolated. That's one thing. But then, when they're isolated for 10 days, is it really the wisest choice to give them so little perceptual and occupational stimulation? Is that a good thing to do? Does that help them calm down? No, it doesn't. And again, the only reason you might think it does is if you think the person is capable of responding to a rational calculus of means and ends. But they don't.
Most of the people that you have been describing fall into the category of mentally ill.
Not necessarily.
Well?
No, I mean, a lot of the people who end up in prison, first of all, are, you know, probably the most common thing is addiction. These are people who tend to be emotionally labile. They tend to be impulsive. Often they have ADHD. Sometimes they have some degree of bipolar disorder, maybe not full-blown manic depression. But that's the kind of person you'll tend to run into in a prison setting. And those people are exceedingly vulnerable. stimulant. They'll calm them down. It's a paradoxical response. Why? Because they're hypo-aroused. They're not alert enough. They're like the overtired child who can't slow down, can't settle down. It's very agitated. Give them a stimulant and they actually calm down. It's a paradoxical response. And that's the paradigm that you should think of what happens when you take a person and deprive them of any occupational environmental stimulation. You're taking that person with ADHD and you're putting them in the most toxic environment you can for that type of individual.
And on the other hand, some subjecting some people to 3 or 4 hours of public radio waves. That the most massive direction.
It's a possibility. Or what about that fellow at the horrible thing, Koresh in Waco, where they put that bad music, that country music to drive him crazy?
Because,
you know, I know what it was. Come on, I didn't even know who it was. No, no way. But the FBI did.
You had a question. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me what you're advocating, I think you have a very good point. You spend plenty of the prisons now before you teaching some of the prisons and spending time on your prison.
I think you need to spend less money. Remember, security costs, I don't like 95%. If you start introducing programs, not just programs, but different, richer paradigms, you're going to spend less money, not more. Now, you know, obviously there's a bit of stuff, but it's true. It's twice as expensive to keep a guy in solitary. Twice as expensive, roughly. You know, that's around the jurisdictions. And the amount of money that's actually gone into programming is tiny. I think it's like 5%. I mean, I don't know what it is in the, but that's sort of the typical thing. So double it, 10%. But if you could cut down on the security needs, save a ton of money.
How could you cut down security needs when the, you know, these people, are, many of them are in prison because they couldn't control themselves?
What I'm saying to you is that if you treat them in prison in a way that helps them gain more control, your security needs are going to decrease. The security needs of a person who's out of control in solitary is about twice as much as the security expense for that same individual in general population.
Thank you very much. Representative Sanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the work session. Could I make a request? Because a claim has been made, I'd like to know if there's any study to show that the recidivism rate of those inmates who have served time in SMU is any different or less or more than those who have not.
Thank you, and we will ask if there are any of our experts who would like to provide that information, and we'll put it on Marion's list. Thank you very much. Seeing no further questions, we thank you very much, Dr. Grassian,
for
coming today. Just for process things, we are now out of the first hour that we did not count the legislators' time against you because we didn't. And so we are going to take one more person.